Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
And now Gordon Carrera begins a new series marking the centenary of Britain's Secret Intelligence Service.
Le chercheur d'or ira à la foire.
I can feel the adrenaline sort of pumping through when I think back to some of the things that I and many others were required to do.
Well, there have been other times in my life where I have been involved in death, yes. But I can't talk about that.
MI6, A Century in the Shadows. Part 1, Gadgets and Green Ink.
For 100 years, the British Secret Service has operated in the shadows, its work shrouded in mystery, our understanding coloured by fiction. In this series for the BBC World Service, we're going on an unprecedented journey inside MI6 to find out what it really does. We'll be hearing from those who've run MI6, those who've spied for it on the front lines, and those who've worked against it. Britain's Foreign Intelligence Service has had its share of triumphs and disasters, and its enemies have taken on different forms. But at its very core, the business of the service has barely changed, collecting what's known as human intelligence. Sir John Scarlett, Chief of the Service, traditionally known as C.
We are seen as the service whose job it is to run human sources, human agents, sources that are capable of telling you secrets, secret intelligence, i.e. information which other people don't want you to have.
The job of an MI6 officer is to recruit agents who'll spy on their behalf, even if that means betraying their own country. Colin McColl, a former chief of MI6.
Ideally, you should have got to know the person, so you've built up some sort of trust. And you're much more likely to get a yes if you've done that.
Must be quite a nerve-wracking moment.
It is. It's exciting.
Asking someone to spy for the country.
Yes, indeed, that's right.
To potentially betray secrets.
Yes, but to betray something that needs betraying.
A Union Jack flutters outside the sixth-floor window of the Chief of the Secret Service, Sir John Scarlett.
A logical place to start is here.
A large safe sits in one corner of the office, while the walls bear witness to the history and myth that define the service, with a collection of pictures, letters and cartoons.
There are lots of cartoons, of course. This one here I've always particularly liked, the sort of Mandarin fellow, the cigarette holder and the cigarette in his mouth, and his shocked wife with a newspaper saying, Britain's spy chiefs named. This comes from October 1967 in the Evening Standard. Quote, 40 years of married life to find out you're not a corned beef inspector, and through the Daily Express. And that's a reminder that naming spy chiefs is an old art.
In another corner stands a grandfather clock built by the first chief of the service, Mansfield Cumming, whose influence endures to the present day. Nearby are a series of official letters, some in distinctive green ink.
Tell me about the green ink. Do you use green ink? Have you got a green pen on your desk?
I do. It is radio, but I promise you green ink comes out of it. And that's a tradition which we have kept.
And you still use that?
Yes.
For signing letters?
Yeah, if you get a note of congratulations, a personal note from the chief, and instead of being just an ordinary ink signed John Scarlett, it's in green ink and it's signed C, it just makes a better impact.
Whitehall Court is now an upmarket hotel situated just behind the great departments of state. An office amid the warren of rooms on the top floor was the ideal hiding place for the first chief, the original C, to begin building a secret service. Our guide, Sir Mansfield Cumming's biographer, Alan Judd.
We know that where he occupied was fairly high up, because there were a lot of stairs going up to it, because there's a very good account of him going down those stairs with only one leg, you know, and how he managed it and so on at the time. And we know that he expanded within it. We know that at least at one point he got permission from the owners to add another room for his typists.
And when it started, how many people were in the Secret Service? How many people would have been in these rooms?
Oh, very, very few. I mean, when it started, it was just him, basically, first of all.
Until the early 20th century, spying was done by the odd gentleman amateur. But fears over a rising Germany, and especially its growing navy, focused minds in Whitehall, aided in no small part by a handful of novelists like Erskine Childers, who created a spy mania that whipped the country into a frenzy.
An interesting document, somewhat damaged by fire, lies on my study table. It is a copy, in cipher, of a confidential memorandum to the German government embodying a scheme for the invasion of England by Germany. It is unsigned, but internal evidence and the fact that it was taken by Mr. Carruthers from the stove of the villa at Norderney leave no doubt as to its authorship.
The Germans were everywhere, it was thought, infiltrating Britain, posing as waiters and barbers. Something had to be done, and so the Secret Service Bureau was set up. One section to hunt for German spies at home, this would become MI5, and another to steal German secrets by recruiting agents abroad, this would become the Secret Intelligence Service, often known as MI6. The Foreign Office and War Office saw the latter job as more than a little grubby, and so a naval captain working on defences on the south coast, Mansfield Cumming, was brought in to do the dirty work for them.
When Cumming took it on, most people whom we would now call spies were sort of mercenary nutcases doing it for money. Brussels was the kind of espionage capital of Europe, if not the world, and you went and hired your services, and there were agencies for spies to go to and to find out things.
So it's quite disreputable in some way.
Yeah, and he refers to them in his diary as these scallywags and mountebanks.
Cumming himself cut an eccentric and formidable figure. He'd freed himself from a car accident in France by cutting off his own leg with a penknife and used a scooter to race round Whitehall. He would alarm new recruits by stabbing his false leg with a paper knife. This account of his office comes from the agent ST-25, otherwise known as Sir Paul Dukes.
On a side table were maps and drawings, with models of aeroplanes, submarines and mechanical devices, while a row of bottles suggested chemical experiments. These evidences of scientific investigation only served to intensify an already overpowering atmosphere of strangeness and mystery.
Cumming's eccentricities did much to define the service's early character, including a love of disguise and of gadgets. In the shadowy den of Whitehall Court, his officers also engaged in their own furtive experiments.
Somehow, they came across the fact that semen could be used as secret ink, and I'm not quite sure how this came about, but apparently it was Cumming's chief censor, a man called Worthington, who announced it one day, and one of his staff had to be moved, apparently, because his colleagues were making life so disagreeable for him, accusations that you might imagine. And they had a slogan that every man his own stylo.
As well as buying secrets on the rather unreliable underground marketplace, Cumming also began the enduring tradition of engaging patriotic British businessmen to do their bit. Those who had access to German dockyards were asked to report back any useful snippets. But the best spy is one who can blend in, and so the most valuable agents were locals, in this case Germans, willing to pass on intelligence to Cumming's officers. John Scarlett.
What's striking is the huge focus on one issue, one threat, which was perceived to be there as a threat to our world position, as a world power. That, of course, was the threat from Imperial Germany, and in particular from the Imperial German Navy. And so, from the very beginning, the chief of SIS and his officers, as he gathered them around him, was looking to recruit human sources, agents.
When war came in 1914, Cumming's small team began to employ networks of locals, often working behind enemy lines.
It's train spotting, really, a lot of it. And these were a group of Belgian professional people who wished to do something about the occupation of their country. And they would get little old ladies who sat in their houses that happened to have windows overlooking railway marshalling yards. And they'd do their knitting. And they'd drop one for a troop train, pearl one for an artillery train, and so on and so on. So it was that basic stuff.
This is Captain S. Payne Best, OB. At the age of 93, just after my birthday.
The closest we can get to first-hand accounts of the challenges of intelligence in the First World War comes from recordings kept in the Imperial War Museum, like the memories of Sigismund Payne Best, speaking just before he died in 1978. Then, as now, a crucial problem was not just collecting secrets, but working out how to get the information back to HQ from behind enemy lines, which is why in one case they even used a hen as a carrier pigeon of sorts.
Well, we tried the model aeroplanes which we shot across. We also tried infrared rays by having a man who had a big oven, a big stove which he heated up, and by standing in front of it and moving away, he could send the dot dash of Morse. Then we had the farmer's wife, who had her sister just the other side of the wire. And she used to give the soldier who was supposed to be guarding the wire a nice piece of fat bacon and ask him in return to take a hen to her sister. Well, obviously, if a hen is taken away from its roost and released at night, it will return by the shortest possible route. And it was in this way that we got the first indication of the German intention to attack at Verdun.
A train journey takes us on behalf of the BBC's World Service to a secret establishment outside of London. I've been asked not to say exactly where it is. There, within a cavernous vault, is a treasure trove of pictures, letters, gadgets and relics from MI6's past, which have never been shown to the public. Showing me round is Cabinet Office historian Mark Seaman, keeper of the secrets.
This relates to an agent known as TR-16, who has had access to details of the German naval units as they returned to German ports after the Battle of Jutland.
And what are these here?
Well, the agent was also able to identify the building of a German warship, the Bayern, and he's made a sketch of it there.
So that's a sketch he would have made of a battleship based on walking around the docks or seeing
exactly.
it?
Exactly, yeah.
On June the 3rd, I learned that the Pilau was coming to Bremen and the München was going to Vegakok. The Pilau arrived at the Vojvodst at 6 a.m. on June the 4th, and I learned from the people of this ship that the Luteon, Rostock and Geidlitz had been lost, although this loss was not acknowledged by the German Admiralty.
The Secret Service was in its infancy during the war, but Cumming managed to do enough to ensure its survival, especially as it soon became clear that there was more than just Germany to worry about. The First World War wasn't even over when MI6 began to turn its attention to a new enemy. Moscow and the Kremlin behind me, where the Communists had seized power in 1917... would become one of the Secret Service's main targets for the rest of the century. The Secret Service, populated exclusively at this time by members of the British ruling class, had a deep and abiding loathing for Bolshevism and soon became involved in more than just collecting intelligence. Its colourful characters like Sidney Reilly, the so-called Ace of Spies, began plotting to undermine and overthrow them. In a 1967 BBC interview, MI6 officer Augustus Agar gives a glimpse of the type of clandestine operation the service conducted, smuggling agents in and out of Russia on fast boats.
We got to the place, waited 5 minutes, 10 minutes, each minute seems an hour, and then I heard a low wail and the sound of oars. Then the three flashes, our secret signal, and within a minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes perhaps, he was alongside.
It didn't take long for the service to be drawn into political intrigue back home. In 1924, one of its agents passed a letter purporting to be from Georgi Zinoviev, head of the Comintern, set up to spread communism around the world. It contained orders from Moscow to supporters in London. Somehow, and it's not clear how, it found its way onto the front page of the Daily Mail with explosive results for the first Labour government. Former Foreign Office historian Jill Bennett.
Of course, once it was in the papers, just as you can imagine, it was like, you know, this government is supporting the Russians who are trying to subvert our constitution and they're inciting our armed forces to revolt. And any hint that the British armed forces might be incited to revolt was particularly inflammatory.
What evidence is there that Secret Service officers leaked the Zinoviev letter to undermine the Labour government?
Well, it's patchy. I mean, some people even think that they concocted it, because the other part of this story is that actually quite soon a lot of people realise this letter is a forgery for a number of reasons. I mean, partly they're technical, to do with how the letter was signed and the way it arrived and so on, and also because the Russians were clearly taken aback.
In the 1930s, MI6 headquarters housed only 20 officers, mainly military men who socialised after work in London's clubs. There was only one graduate and he kept it quiet. At exactly the same time, MI6's Soviet counterparts were proving rather more adept at graduate recruitment, particularly in Cambridge. But attention was switching from Russia back to Germany. MI6's record on Nazi rearmament was patchy, and even when it did get information, for instance on the German Air Force, politicians seemed to have ignored it because it conflicted with their policy of appeasement. When the Second World War broke out, the service was at its lowest ebb, its intelligence networks disrupted and destroyed. And one more humiliation awaited. Mark Seaman.
We're looking at some photographs here of two SIS officers, Captain Sigismund Payne Best and Major Richard Stevens, who were leading players, some might say victims, in one of the service's less happy activities, now called the Venlo incident.
Sigismund Payne Best, whom we heard earlier talking about the First World War, had risen to be a senior officer in the service. On November 9th, 1939, he and a colleague went to a cafe in the Dutch border town of Venlo. They were expecting to meet two German officers, whom they understood might be willing to work against Hitler.
I know I was standing next to Stevens when four of these men had jumped off and rushed towards us. Stevens said to me, "Our number's up." It's the last I heard of him, 5.5 years. And the next moment, there were two fellows in front of each of us, a man holding his pistol to her head and the other fellow putting handcuffs on. Then the Germans shouted at us, "March!" And prodding us in the back with their pistols and calling out, "Hoop, hoop, hoop," they rushed us along towards the German frontier.
They had been lured into the trap, and as a result of their capture, they did provide a substantial amount of information to their captors. Became a causus belli for the Germans some 6 months later when they invaded the Netherlands.
MI6's contribution to the war effort has largely been overshadowed by the success of code-breaking at Bletchley Park and work led by MI5, turning German agents back against the Nazis. MI6's sabotage section was also hived off to become the Special Operations Executive, or SOE, charged with setting Europe ablaze. While SOE blew things up, MI6's task was to quietly gather intelligence on the movement of German troops and the new military hardware they were employing.
We're looking at some what are called concealing devices that were developed during the Second World War. These particular ones include a cork from a bottle that has been hollowed out and that actually contains a little compartment for concealing messages, and also a hairbrush that has a particular swivel on one side that reveals a hidden compartment.
Across occupied Europe, small groups of patriotic individuals were determined to resist the Nazis and offered their services to British intelligence. In the village of Plamodien in Brittany, the local doctor began to aid British airmen and drew together people willing to provide information. His children also became involved, including his 14-year-old daughter Marguerite, now in her 80s and living in Scotland.
I was quite young, but they treated me just like one of them, because I really brought a lot of information without being caught.
How often would you see something happen as a result of that information? Like a bomb being dropped or something like that?
Oh, immediately. Well, they were very, very quick. And besides, there was a kick, you know, whenever something blew up that you had given the information, poof, that was a victory every time. You can imagine that, he would do it.
Ici Londres, les Français parlent au français.
MI6 communicated with its agents through coded message personnel broadcast on the BBC.
Voici notre huitième bulletin d'information au cours duquel vous entendrez quelques messages personnels.
Le chercheur d'or ira à la foire.
Did you get message personnel on the BBC?
Yes. Oh, yes, we did get, yes. Then we took the message. If it was one word, you see, that was for us, then we would start writing madly.
MI6 agents would be supplied with a radio set and could also choose from an array of gadgets, some of which have been preserved by MI6 in its vault.
What I'm showing you now are some sabotage devices developed by SIS just before the outbreak of the Second World War. The rather strange-looking long objects are called time pencils, and they are a means of initiating a delayed explosion. Well, you couldn't exactly buy this spy equipment online, but you could certainly choose from a catalogue. The risk was sometimes, if you talked to some of the veterans at the time, that they were worried that if anybody got to see the full range, the agents would have sort of been groaning under the weight of all the equipment that they took with them.
One of the most successful spy rings in France was run by Marie-Madeleine Foucard, interviewed by the BBC more than 40 years ago. Her network's use of animal code names led the Nazis to christen them Noah's Ark. Through the war, the network had 3,000 members, 500 of whom lost their lives to the Gestapo.
I can remember a little girl, aged 12. Her parents were arrested and tortured in front of the child because they didn't want to see where was the radio operator and where was the set. And the child knew everything and she didn't see.
By the end of the war, the actions not so much of the officers of MI6 as the patriotic agents who worked for them in occupied Europe had made a difference. But those men and women had paid a heavy price.
Some of them were caught, of course, with the radio, and then they were tortured until they talk. But the idea was that you don't talk for a week to give a chance to everybody to escape or to hide.
Were many people caught?
Oh, yes, oh, yes. We couldn't really enjoy the liberation because so many of them had died, really.
As one war ended, another was just beginning. A Cold War, a war fought largely in the shadows, and one in which intelligence was to be the front line.
MI6, A Century in the Shadows, was written and presented by Gordon Carrera. The producer of the programme was Mark Savage. Next week, the Cold War.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. For details of them all, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.